the re-election of President Reagan to be the development hope for us, it will not change the basic situation. It may set a stage favorable for us. But don't expect on November 7th to have a sudden dramatic change in the climate. I'm a political realist because I recognize that the intellectual, social, and the economic and the political decline which have overtaken the nation have been a long time to make. And therefore, it's like a long and progressive cancer. You can begin a radium treatment, you can begin a chemotherapy treatment, but 1 week later you're not healed. And the political process is the same. Now, having said that, the question then is this: how have we gotten to where we are? How do we lose this heritage in political thinking, in constitutional thinking, in our legal thought, in our educational thought, in our social thought, in our economic thought? How do we lose it? In our literary heritage? One of you, I think it was Harry, made the point that students today in the school simply can't read great literature. They can't. Oh, there are some good ones that you have pointed out. Yeah, there sure are. Some survive in spite of the onslaught against them. May I make two statements? The persistent and the consistent enemy of our heritage has been the philosophy of democracy.
Say that again, please.
The consistent and persistent enemy of our heritage, of our culture, has been the philosophy of democracy. I don't believe in democracy. As a Christian, I can't. Democracy is a political exhibition or statement of humanism, and as such must be eschewed by every devout Christian. I believe in the Constitution, but the Constitution is not democratic. At least it wasn't when it was formed. Today, you will see that this is the truth. Now, that's the first great enemy. The second great enemy... yes, sir.
Has one of the great problems been the term itself?
Pardon me?
The term democracy itself. By it, then the popular usage just simply means everything good that's ever taken place in this country. It doesn't mean equal power or anything like that, or even specifically a form of government.
The word demos in Greek means the people of the mob. It's not the lambda alpha omicron treatment. It's the demos. Rule the mob. Kratio, and to rule in power in Greek. Kratio. Demos. Demokratio, to rule the mob.
Well, what we have done to that word is to almost replace Christianity with democracy.
Yes, many people think Christian and democracy are identical. They are totally antithetical. Now, in our ensuing discussions, I shall show you how this has undermined our heritage throughout our history and how we got to where we are today. The second enemy, which is kin to the first, but should probably have a separate heading, is the practical application of democracy in the realm of social reform and revolution. Now let me make this third statement. More biblical your theology, the more biblical your political philosophy resulting from theology, the more political your legal theory, the more biblical your legal theology, the Lloyd-Bennett theology, the more biblical your educational philosophy, the Lloyd-Bennett theology, the more biblical your social philosophy, emanating from that theology, the more biblical your economic philosophy, emanating from that theology, the greater will be the attack upon. Let me ask you a very candid question. When the lampoonists get busy today, lampooning Christianity in this country and mocking the Puritans, what form of theology do they attack? Calvinism. Writers galore. From Oliver Wendell Holmes, when writing the One Horse Shed, when he used the One Horse Shed to depict the collapse of Calvinism, that famous poem about 140 years ago, 50 years ago now, down to the modern novelist who loved to depict the somber, stern views of Calvinism from which the young hero attempts to escape, or the newspaper columnist who will take his fling at Calvinism as if it were some awful, terrible ogre that hovers over the American scene ready to destroy liberty. They don't attack Lutheranism. They don't attack Methodism as theology. They always attack Calvinism. And why is that? There's a reason. These columnists, these commentators, these novelists, these writers, like H.L. Mencken, Thomas Wolfe, and many others, I'm just sort of yanking names out of them. These writers know that if somehow they can destroy historic Orthodox Calvinism, that the whole theological and ecclesiastical structure in this country will fall crashing to the ground.
Are these contemporary people you're talking about? Or is this...
Well, Mencken died some 40 years ago. I sort of yanked him. Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman. To mention more contemporary.
Haven't pretty much most of the writers today become ignorant of the distinction between different denominations to the point where they just link them as being, you know, these born again people over again?
Well, this is true lately because of the popularity of Jerry Falwell. I don't mean to dig toward him, but I mean they're lampooning him today, but they don't realize that without Calvinism in this country, Falwell would not last a day. Do you know where Falwell's been getting his inspiration? Who was guiding him? Francis Schaeffer. I know that. And Schaeffer left his library too, that school up there. Pardon me? Did you have a question?
I said I didn't know that.
Most people don't. Fowler was in close communication with Francis Schaeffer. And in theology, except for the belief in the Trinity and the deity of Christ and his senses redeemer, they had very little in common.
So are you linking Fowler's activism in politics and everything to your influence from Schaeffer?
And didn't they merge with Schaeffer? No, because before Jerry Falwell came into contact with Schaeffer about I'm going to say 4 years ago, possibly three. And he invited Schaeffer to come to Liberty Baptist Seminary and College. And Schaeffer went. And you may remember, if you follow Mr. Falwell at all, that he used Francis Schaeffer on some of his programs. I don't want to use the word enamored, but he recognized in Schaeffer a foundation and a theological quality which he lacked, and which he still lacks. But Yes,
sir. I think that's a good reason why Schaefer would give his books to Falwell, because he recognized that there was something there he could do for Falwell.
I was not criticizing Schaefer for that. I think he did it. I think it was the right thing to do. I was not in any way criticizing.
No, I realize that.
No, I didn't mean it that way. Schaefer sensed this. I have one of the last letters that Schaefer ever wrote. He wrote to me. And I prize it.
Can you give a couple of other contemporary examples? I can see what you're saying with Falwell, except in the fact that it's only been about the last 4 years, because the moral majority has been around before that. I'm not sure where the influence of Calvinism is affecting things.
What I am saying is this. That Fall was theology, and Fall was approach without having a Calvinist background in this country, would not survive. And it wouldn't. But this is not just true of Jerry Falwell. This is true of all these modern evangelists. You see, the background of biblical morality in this country, as it lives in groups, is in the historic Orthodox Calvinist. Oftentimes, I don't think we realize the impact we have on this country. We're a minority. Incidentally, Mr. Falwell's group is really the moral minority.
Yeah.
But I'm not laughing at it for that reason. He's not a majority, but it is a vocal, vociferous, and rather effective minority. Because he has a great deal of charisma, whatever you want to call it. I don't mean that deprecatory. I'm not depreciating it at all. I'm simply making a statement.
If it weren't being effective, it wouldn't be lampooned as much.
No. See, they don't take on others the way they do him. Now, they may laugh at Oral Roberts because of his huge hospital, which is facing financial difficulties. But but they took. I listened to Barbara and Mr. Bush last night, and Barbara. I mean, what's her name?
Geraldine.
But Jerry Falwell. Huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now. If you'll think it over, you'll find out I'm correct.
Well, I'm not arguing so much.
Oh, I thought you were. Please do.
Well, my point of argument then is more in the fact I'm trying to substantiate your answer. I can see what you're saying with Falwell, because Falwell is very vocal. And he's practically the only one who is standing out vocally, except for maybe Wilderman, who's from the Methodist background.
He's down in Mississippi?
Yeah. And historically, I can see a lot of that more than I can today.
Well.
But it almost sounds like what you're saying is the other denominations are sitting back very immorally, just doing whatever they want.
I was not saying.
Substantiation from you.
I did not say that. I did not mean that. What I meant was that the Calvinistic heritage forms the frame of reference and the background for his social activity. Now, it is true that he rejects the Calvinism in theology, which he uses in his. Reform work. He rejected. But this is what Francis Schaefer saw, that he's rejecting the groundwork, he's rejecting the foundation of his own program. Now, I know that for a fact. I probably shouldn't use him, but it happened to come to mind.
Is there any solid non-Calvinistic conservative theology in this country?
No. It's been riddled either by dispensationalism, neo orthodoxy, or other forms of liberalism. From the God is Dead movement on down or up, as the case might be.
Are you saying then that Francis Schaefer could see that at some point in time Jerry Falwell would see the light?
Now, I read some of the correspondence between them. I do not have it in my possession. In essence, what you say is what Falwell saw. I mean, what Francis Schaefer saw. I'm not sure let me go a step further. I think from a friend of mine who's on the faculty of the seminary there, who is a Calvinist, a Reformed Baptist, that Paul is beginning to be aware of. However, Jerry's problem is this, as a very practical problem, but very real, that he has sown the seed of dispensational theology and Baptist separatism and premillennialism so thoroughly in his huge church and his TV audience that he does not know how to make any changes without alienating the source of his income. That is his dilemma today. Now, I talked to a person. I lectured in the seminary chapel 2 years ago. I was then lectured in the chapel through the courtesy of this friend of mine who got the dean to invite me to give a talk. I talked on Christian worship, fear and trembling. And I think that Paul is aware of this. Paul was also influenced to a degree by Carl Henry, who I think was the, if I understand right, who was the link that got Paul and Francis Schaeffer together.
How's it going? Farwell is, he's beginning to have, you're talking about problem with his colleagues.
Yeah.
The soul of the Lord has come out and criticized him with his non-separatist stand. And some of the people that were on the board of the sword have given up their jobs on the sword, you know, on the board, because, you know, there is an alienation there. Now, there was before the Joneses were, they came out just with it and announced Falwell because of his
I'm aware of that fact. You see, let me, in defense of Falwell, say this. Falwell cannot do what he wants to do and maintain the Bob Jones degree of doctor separation, or that is the sword of the Lord. He can't do it. And Paul was forced to make a choice between them on the one hand or pursuing his identity, and he made the choice to pursue his aim.
What do you mean by the doctrine of separation?
I'm going to give you the Bob Jones. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't chew, I don't go with them, I do. Now, in broader terms, Bob Jones University has, and as an evangelist, has taken a stand. He will have no fellowship with anyone in any church which is a denomination. He called them apostate, Presbyterian, Baptist, Lutheran, Methodist, so on, Reformed, or in any way in fellowship, even remotely, with the National Council of Churches. Now, I have no use for the National Council of Churches, but it is true that many good people have been deceived. And because they've been deceived, you can't slap them under the ankle and be with you no more. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. In other words, I mean, now, John R. Rice, the editor of the Sword of the Lord, I had known. See, I began my college teaching after I got out of the war service at Wheaton College. And he's published the Sword of the Lord in Wheaton College. And I'm going to turn that thing on. Covenant mandate. But he realized that something has to be done. He has a sense of sin, national and personal. A deep sense of sin. And I give him credit for it. Those who criticize him, the separate and the non-separation, have no concept of the covenant theology or the covenant mandate of creation to occupy the world and to subdue the world for Christ. Now, this is an inevitable part of the dispensational theology. They are logical. There's no question about it. Paul holds the dispensationalism, but he violates the basic concept of dispensationalism in his whole approach. He preaches the imminent return of Christ on the one hand, and then plans 50 years for his university on the other. And that's true.
That's right. That's true.
I'm not dragging things up. Now, I'm not criticized for his planning. It's per se. But if you really believe that Christ will come back tomorrow, then all the money he gave toward the university is wrong. But if he has the concept of occupy till I come under the creation mandate, then he has a clear case that justifies his position. You see my point? No, you don't, do you?
Oh, yeah, I see. He's inconsistent in his theology and his thinking, like that's what everybody else is about a whole lot of things.
That's where A.B. Simpson knew what he was talking about back last century. When he built Niagara College, the first building they had built was a very rickety old wooden building that they had to condemn while I was a student there, simply because it was too dangerous to occupy it anymore. But he was convinced the Lord would come back before he died.
Well, he's always making to bring our minds back to what I was trying to get at. Is that throughout our history, Calvinism has been the focal point of attack. Because its critics, its enemies, in the past at least, have known that if they can destroy Calvinism, they can destroy the American constitutional system, the American legal system, the American political system, the economic system, its educational system, and its social system. They know that. Now, whether they know it today or they used to know is another question. But that has been the pivotal point of attack. Because the whole American heritage rests upon the continued impact of Calvinism on the American nation. Now, you may not like what I'm saying. You may disagree with me. That is your privilege. But I have been studying history for over 50 years. And I think that over the years, my thinking has crystallized. I hope not into too hard crystals, but I have read book after book after book, and I was trained to go back to the original source.
Well, did you think there
was
a conspiracy?
If you mean by that a written conspiracy, solemnly signed, probably not. Although there are those in some groups, yes. But more to the point, I think there's been a widespread common agreement between the TV people, the newspaper commentators, and people, lecturers like that, and politicians. But it's not signed and sealed. Now, where it does exist as an agreement is in education. Education is the greatest danger we face today. The public schools are the poison of the nation.
The idea is one world government. Is that what you're thinking about?
Would you recommend Rush reading a book on that?
Which one?
The Messianic Character of American
History. I certainly would. for the background for what I'm saying in regard to education, R.J. Rushdie's book, The Messianic Character of American Education, is the only book worth reading in that field. It's an excellent book. It's one of his best, in my humble opinion. Now,
what would be a similar book on economics?
There isn't any. Well, if you can, well, you've done it. My From Rational to Irrationality covers economics, as very few books do. It covers education, it covers political science, it covers art, music.
Okay.
From Rationalism to Irrationality.
Yeah.
I don't carry it with me because it's bulky and I don't keep it home for sale for that reason, but you can get it from the Christian Reformed Publishing Company.
That's a conspiracy thing. I think when we talk about conspiracy, sometimes we mean some kind of thing like that, out of a sacrilegious novel or something like that.
Yeah.
But look at the way, for instance, with the liberals took over the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah.
The Presbyterian Church.
There was a conspiracy in the Southern Presbyterian Church. It was known as the St. James Fellowship. And it was found some 40 years ago at the Union Seminary in Richmond. Now, so far, the Southern Church is not that way. See, some of you don't know this, but I was president of Concerned Presbyterians after Ken Kyes resigned in November 1973. I was the second and final last president of that organization. At that time, we had about 90,000 members.
When was it?
I was president in 1973 and 1976. Ken Kyes resigned when the Shenandoah Church won the PCA, and it looked somewhat incongruous for him to be directing a PCUS organization since I was still in it. They had a meeting here in Atlanta in November 1973, and I was teaching, of course, and I couldn't come. And so that night, Ken Kyes and Roy LaCroix called me up and said, "Congratulations." Well, when I heard those two on the phone, I had some tremors going through me because I recognized they were my friends, and there's a little defense against them. And Ken Kyes said in a cheery voice, "Congratulations." And I said, "What for?" He said, "You've just been elected my successor as president of Concerned Presbyterians." I certainly didn't buy the job. I didn't campaign for it. I was elected because I wasn't there to defend myself.
Well, Dr. Singleton, would one explanation to this be that you don't have perhaps the kind of conspiracy politically, but you do have, I mean, liberals are after all ideologies of red, and that is going to act in a sense like a conspiracy.
I said in the sense of a written conspiracy, no. But you see, there was a conspiracy in the Roosevelt administration headed by Harry Hopkins to bring in only those people who would follow Roosevelt. And there was a secret agreement in the Roosevelt at the era. The real conspiracy was in bringing on Pearl Harbor, which I shall address in another course.
Has that continued into the trilateral position?
Yes. the same group. Well, let me go back. Just after World War I, they founded the Foreign Policy Society in this country to create a source of strength for joining the League of Nations, the American Council on Foreign Affairs. That was funded by the Rockefeller and others, who incidentally had helped fund our entrance into World War I. The Council on Foreign Relations directed or tried to direct our foreign affairs down until World War II, and they had the control. Well, it hadn't been found yet, but they controlled Lansing. They met a problem under Wilson when Mr. Wilson appointed, after he had so much trouble with others, he appointed Joseph C. Grew as his final Secretary of State. And Grew was an old line patriot, and they had considerable problems. But with Harding, there was no problem. And with Cooley, there wasn't much problem. There were problems with Hoover. Because Hoover was a man of great ability, and because of his war experience, he was not unfamiliar with the council's dedication to alien activities. of course, Roosevelt worked right in with it. There was absolutely no doubt of any kind but that Pearl Harbor was a result of a conspiracy. There's no question. You may not like what I say. Frankly, I don't care. It was a result of conspiracy.
You haven't already talked about the dispensationalism.
Oh, the question. Dispensationalism was a theology brought about in the Plymouth Brethren in England in the 1830s. And basically, it is a theology which holds in its earliest form, that God has dealt with men in seven different dispensations, in which of those dispensations he has dealt with men on different bases. He's tried them and found them wanting, beginning with Adam, Noah, and so on, and the new dispensation coming of Christ. But that is not the end. The seventh dispensation will be when Christ comes again, and you'll have your thousand year reign.
That's Scopius.
Yeah. Scopius was the great American expositor at this point of view. J.N. Darby was the man who brought it into its influential form, and it was adopted wholesale by the Plymouth Brethren. I came to this country with the publication of Scopius' Bible, originally 1914 and 1916, and it grabbed hold of Moody's Bible Institute, and it became the dominant force in what we call Summer Bible Conference movement, particularly in the Keswick movement and related Bible conference, because it hit and took over Keswick in England. And there's a northern Keswick in New Jersey, there's a southern Keswick down at the, in Florida, at the, Buckle Raton, yeah.
My brother used to be headmaster of that school.
You did?
My brother was.
And it swamped the Bible College movement in Texas. And it has swamped the Baptist churches. Because we've got the sign of orthodoxy.
Was Moody's Bible Institute not originally dispensational?
No.
See, he found it before Scopus came into being.
Was he pretty much reformed at that point,
though? He was not reformed, but he was not a Pelagian either. I'm talking about Moody now.
Yeah.
He certainly was no Billy Sunday.
Was he an attempt to replace the covenant structure with another covenant?
No, in fact, it denied the covenant.
Well, I mean, it denied, but what I mean is, was it an attempt to replace the covenant with another covenant?
Yes. With seven covenants, but each of them a failure.
I mean, otherwise, It would imply that God failed.
They didn't imply it, they said it. And of course, Scofield, you know, says that the church is an accident. That if the Israelites had accepted Christ as their sovereign earthly king, there would have been no need of a church. The church is only an interim institution.
Parenthesis.
A great parenthesis. Now, have I answered your question there?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, obviously, please keep in mind always the question before us is how did we get where we are? And of course, the debate or the campaign underway. Now, it was suggested I leave about half hour for questions, wasn't it? That time has come. I shall continue with this, with deism and the period from 1776 to about 1830, 40, 50 next time. But I wouldn't like to.
You've got a whole hour yet.
Oh, do I? That's fine. You have a question?
Besides, who was in the Pearl Harbor conspiracy and what was their motivation?
Roosevelt, generals in the army.
Roosevelt, Morgenthau,
Secretary of State Cradell Hall. Harold Dickey, and the so-called War Cabinet, which met formally at noontime on Wednesday, December the 3rd, at which time Roosevelt brought the announcement that the attack would come that next Monday. And they said, this is war. Roosevelt said, yes, it's war. I've seen copies of those documents. I saw some of the original documents. That is a real conspiracy. It was known by about five or six people. Henry Ball was in on it.
Well, if they knew it was coming, why did they want to open up with a disease?
Pardon me?
Why did they want to open up with a disease?
With a what?
With a disease.
Well,
instead of...
See, this is a good question. Roosevelt had ordered the scouting plane out of Pearl Harbor over to Guam and summoned Samoa. Roosevelt had consistently discounted the report given by, at that time, Ambassador Joseph C. Drew to him concerning Japanese planes. What Roosevelt wanted, what was brought out of the Pearl Harbor reports was that Roosevelt wanted a limited attack. He wanted an attack which would galvanize the American people into action, but he did not expect what did take place. Now, the question is, why did he do this? The answer is very simple. If you will go back to the Gallup poll of 1939, when they took it during the summer of that year, how many people want war, are willing to go to war with Japan and Germany? About 90% were not willing. It went up 85-90%, but it was an overwhelming majority opposed to war. Under those conditions, there was no way of getting Congress to declare war. No way at all. And if you'll read Roosevelt's papers, which are available, I think, you will see this brought out. You will see it brought out in the fellow who wrote the war, the great diplomatic professor up at Georgetown University, Dr. Charles Tansel, who was one of the finest Roman Catholic scholars this country's ever had. He was a Roman Catholic, but he never let his addiction to the Pope, if he had one. I don't know if he had one, but he had it. But anyway, he never allowed his Roman Catholic membership to dilute his academic scholarship. He was honest and straightforward, and I often wonder how he got a hold of the material, because he published his book, Backdoor to War, and it's very dangerous to do so. But he had it straight, and he's got some in there. Basically, Roosevelt had made an agreement in the famous ABC and ABD meetings in January 1939 with the British government. Namely, I said 41, excuse me, that we would go to war against Germany and against Japan, and the ABD agreement said we'd do it without involving China. The ABC agreement included China. There were two different agreements that we would go to war. Now the problem was how to get to do it. In March 1941, Roosevelt practically declared war in Germany with the passage of the Lend-Lease Act. All the well-known international lawyers and diplomatic historians of the day said that this is a declaration of war. We were aiding one side at the expense of the other. When Roosevelt decided to then aid the sending of the supply by using American destroyers to attack German submarines and warplanes, anybody that would interfere with, he was committing acts of war. Josiah Bailey, a very able senator from North Carolina, got up in the Senate and said, "This is war." And the democratically controlled Senate didn't want to listen to him. He was a Democrat, still.
But what did they do with the neutrality act? And then we have
the act of 1937, which was the strongest of our acts, was modified in 1939 when Roosevelt forced a bill through Congress.
That
was after the war started, mm-hmm. And there was popular sentiment for sending aid to the Allies. The average American did not recognize or realize or understand the requirements of international law, which, put in brief, is if you aid two sides who are belligerents, you are not guilty of violating international law. If your aid, say, to Germany was equal to your aid of England, then you are not guilty of violating international law. But if you would send aid to England and not to Germany, then you were guilty of violating international law. Or if you didn't send aid to either, which was the provision in the Act of 1937, you were not guilty of violating international law. But you see, when war came in September 1939, the Act of 37 was still in the books. The result was that Roosevelt could not aid England against Germany without violating that act. So, under the pressure of patriotism and poor old England and so on, the act was revised to dilute that requirement, or the prohibition, I should say. And that was in Chicago, that was passed in November 1939, about 2 months after the war had started. What most people don't know, and I've never told you this before, but some of you will remember Norman Davies. Does that name ring a bell with you?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know who he was.
Well, he was head of the American Red Cross and had been for years a highly respected man. In November 1939, Roosevelt sent him on a secret mission to Adolf Hitler to see, ostensibly, to see what could be done about the war. Norman Davies was well received by Hitler, and Hitler sent to Mr. Roosevelt an outline of a treaty by which Hitler would end the war and restore the territory he had taken from France if Roosevelt tore off the English dogs of war. Hitler was so exhilarated by this that he gave a message to the Reichstag that the war would be over. This was published in the Berlin Zeitung, the German newspaper, and other places as well. Now, Norman Davies went there with a full plenipotentiary power to deal with Hitler. In other words, he was an ambassador with full portfolio, to put it in English. He came back to Washington, and Mr. Roosevelt refused to receive him. That's the absolute truth.
If something changed his mind?
No. Roosevelt, in the summer of 1939, had made the final decision to go to war. My authority for that is Justice Brent Dice and Justice Frankfurt, Supreme Court, who did the work on Roosevelt's papers. This is summer 1939.
Before it actually started.
Yeah, but he knew it was going to start.
Everybody knew.
Yeah. Now, I think I told you about the agreement between, or the attempted agreement between Hitler and Churchill. Did I tell you about the German Treaty of 19... What?
I don't
know that. No. In 1900... in 1938, Stalin sent a diplomatic memorandum to Hitler. Now, I have seen a copy of it, and I'm not going to in full length, but I'm going to quote to you the main idea. This is August 1938. At that time, Stalin suggested to Hitler that if Hitler would allow Stalin to take over Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and European Turkey, that Stalin would not object if Hitler took over parts of France, notably Alsace-Lorraine, the Saar Basin, and eastern Belgium, and a couple of provinces of the Netherlands. Well, Hitler hit the panic button and sent the whole kit and caboodle to Churchill, to Chamberlain. Chamberlain hit the panic button And on August the 25th or 26th, Germany and England signed the agreement of that period, by which they each agreed to attack Russia if Russia would attack West Britain. It was a mutual defense pact. What's the matter, sir? Do you not believe this?
I'm not sure. I can't understand how the British and Americans really. I can't understand all these how these nations like that would really have any concern with a backward nation like Russia.
Well,
as it is today.
But wait a minute.
Still.
Russia was advancing westward, and Hitler knew it. I'm telling you the absolute truth.
They wanted that backward military.
They wanted that backward military. Mm-hmm. And Hitler knew it. Result was...
Now, was this part of the Munich agreement?
The Munich agreement was the result of this. Now, this agreement was signed in 1938. Because of this, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. Now, let me give you the history of that thing. In 1919, there was a section of Czechoslovakia which was German, that was north and northwest of Prague. Wilson had promised that to Germany, because it was German-speaking under his doctrine of self-determination. When it was brought up at the Versailles Conference, Lloyd George said this would be over his dead body. Poincaré and Clemenceau said it would be over their dead bodies. And it looked to Wilson like he was going to have a collection of dead bodies. And they forced him to back down. And so they gave it to Czechoslovakia. Now, Czechoslovakia persecuted, I don't mean with death, but I mean they were very, very rough on the German elements in Czechoslovakia, because Czechoslovakia was largely composed of Slavs, Bohemians, and whatnot. And between them, the Germans have been centuries of bad blood. Now, Czechoslovakia had the upper hand, and they made the most of it. And yes, it was.
It had not been part of,
or
had been part of the Austrian Empire?
Yeah, it had been part of the Austrian Empire. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the state land. In September, Hitler announced his intention of taking over the Sudetenland. Now, without going to all the language, Roosevelt issued a bombastic statement against Hitler. That was a dastardly thing to do. You may remember that Chamberlain went twice to Munich, and on the third time, on September 30th, 1938, they signed what was called the infamous Munich Agreement, which Roosevelt blasted. Now, what people didn't know was this, and this document I saw, that Roosevelt had sent a statement to Chamberlain to sign the Munich Agreement. And Roosevelt double-crossed Chamberlain. But Chamberlain acted in good faith so far as Roosevelt's secret agreement was concerned. Now, Roosevelt knew about the agreement was between Hitler and Chamberlain. But for political purposes at home, you may remember that Roosevelt was in dire trouble. In 1938, Roosevelt had tried to unseat Senator George, Senator Anders, and Senator Cotton Ed Smith
and Senator Pat McCarran, with whom I worked, 9 senators. Because they had defeated Supreme Court in the primaries, he had tried to unseat his own Democrats. These were all Democrats. When the elections were held, all these men were renominated, and they were all reelected. And when they got back to the Senate in 1938, or November 9th, they were not very good. Well, they were bad. They didn't like Mr. Roosevelt, to put it mildly. Now, when Senator Russell came back, he became chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, a military committee. George was chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. All these men, among them Carter Glass of Virginia, Senator Byrd of Virginia, held positions of power, so that after that, Roosevelt could not get a domestic New Deal bill through Congress. He never got it until the war came. And then he had trouble. Roosevelt had, and you may remember that before the Republicans, in before the election in 1930, had 17 members of the Senate. Now, they only elected 8 new ones, but one of those new ones was the fellow by the name of Senator Robert A. Taft, who soon became a nemesis to Roosevelt, no matter what happened. But in the House, the Republicans doubled their membership, and immediately they formed what was known as the Dixiecrat Republican Coalition, which ruled the House for many years. Roosevelt was in dire political trouble, and he knew it. Now, you can find this in his papers, if you take yourself to go through his papers. There's a bunch of that material. He knew it. Result was that what he did, he changed his whole approach. And he began this loud thumping about German atrocities and so on, which were taking place. I'm not denying that, but he also overlooked the great purge of the Soviet farmers in 1938, which had been much, much worse than anything Hitler ever dreamed of. Are you following me? All right, now, as a result of this upheaval, in 1939, Roosevelt had agreed on war. Why? He realized, see, the election of 1930 had cut the cord between him and the liberals. His liberals were out of office. He now had a conservative Congress on his hands. How do you cope with a conservative Congress? You cope with them on the basis of their opposition to Hitler. And so he began talking in 1939. I heard him. I promise you that as long as I am president, not a mother's son would die on foreign soil. He could say it much more dramatically. And he said that again and again and again. He was plotting at the same time to have them die in foreign soil. Oh, yeah. Roosevelt was a very adept liar. If you go through his public statements, his platform statements, his campaign promises from 1932 to 1944, you'll see he very seldom told the truth on public issues.
Don't you think the Southern politicians would rather have his attack than his endorsement?
Well, I remember, there's a young Atlanta lawyer who ran against George in 1938. I talked to Roy Troy about this, and I asked him if he remembered this fellow. He said vaguely, but he couldn't remember why. And in that primary, Senator George got the largest primary vote in the history of Georgia. I think it was 1,000,000 to 100,000. It was some funny number. And at Barnesville in July 1938, Roosevelt had visited George's hometown, and they had a big rally, and at which Senator George had told the people of Georgia that Senator George was unfit to be in the federal Senate, and had ripped him apart. And as he limped across, to his seat next to Senator George, he put his hand on George's shoulder and said, "God bless you, Walter." the evening of that primary election day in September 1938, Senator George sent from Barnesville this very nice, interesting telegram. Thank you, Walter Franklin. God did bless me. Walter F. George. That's a true story. You see, to be opposed to Roosevelt in the South was a sure way of getting elected.
I remember him saying, if I were a citizen of Georgia, I would vote for whoever it was.
Morris
Camp. That's right, Morris Camp. I asked Roy LaCroix. I asked Roy LaCroix, that's not true, isn't it? About whatever happened, and you asked me who they got the most.
I never heard
of it. Well, it was the goal of the thing, I think, that irritated everybody. I mean, we didn't
want
people to tell
them that. Yeah. Roosevelt had lost his liberal majority in Congress. Now, how do you regain political power? All right, you play a whole new ball game. And that's what he did. But he didn't tell him what the ball game was going to be. Now, he lambasted Churchill publicly and secretly he told him to do it. In the summer of 1939, which is the first documents I saw, they were dated, as I remember, July 11th, 1939. I'm not sure the exact day, but it was in July. So you could see Roosevelt begin to plan for war. There's no doubt about it. It was coming. you may remember that in the first 6 months of that war, it was called the Phony War. Well, that was because Hitler was in constant communication with Chamberlain. Why? Very simple. He was trying to get Chamberlain to reinstate the treaty against Russia. And he told Chamberlain that on June he was going to attack Russia. Chamberlain told Secretary of State Cordell Hull, which turned out to be a very foolish thing to do, because Roosevelt used all his influence and power to keep Chamberlain from accepting the overtures made by Hitler.
You mean the phony war now, during that period of actual negotiations going on under the scenes, simply was not a stalling, yet there was an attempt to stop it, didn't
it? No, it was a... It was due to the political diplomatic maneuverings going on backstage, part of which was Norman Davis's visit, and others.
Now you say that Roosevelt actually sent Norman Davis and then wouldn't...
But did not receive him.
When he came back.
Mm-hmm.
What did Mr. Davis do after that?
He had never given up being chairman of the Red Cross. This was just a special mission. And
he never said anything or wrote anything?
To my knowledge, he didn't. I've never seen it. After all, it wasn't something of which is very... I mean, to be sent as a special ambassador and then not even get a crack in the White House door, you know, it didn't go over very well. But as far as I've known, he never said a word. He may have to friends, but I mean not in public. Now, you may remember the events of the war, and finally, yes.
The crux of the matter here is not what it says. The left feared Hitler so much more than it did the Russians.
That's right.
They haven't seen anything much wrong with Russia.
No.
They still don't?
No, they don't. the liberals in this country have never seen anything wrong with Russia. They keep bringing up... Now, I'm not for a moment defending Hitler. I'll make that very clear. But when they captured the papers in Berlin at the end of the war, the military commissioner said this, and I'm again paraphrasing, that they didn't find a thing in the war plan in Berlin that had ever contemplated war in this country. And they did find several other factors. One, that Hitler had told his army generals and navy commanders not to magnify and not to blow up the American attacks when they were on the convoy, when they were attacking German ships. He also issued an order for the German newspapers to lay off. In other words, he did everything that he could to keep down a hard feeling between the United States and Germany.
Is that why he called Rommel back?
What?
Is that why he called Rommel back?
Partly. Now, I should tell you this. I knew when I was with the War Manpower Commission, I met a man named Fritz Kleinmann, who was the nephew of Martin Niemöller, the great German Lutheran leader. He was in this country studying when the war broke out, and I guess he wrote his phone, I don't know where he did anyway, he got in touch with Martin Niemöller, asked him what he could do. And Niemöller said, stay where you are. Don't get in. And he also told him to help the United States. So, but he soon became a confidant and a source of information for the State Department. But he was a lonely German student. He was lonely as he could be. He butchered the English language, and he didn't mind drinking beer, because that was his training. But he said he couldn't understand where the people in the State Department guzzled liquor, so they didn't know where they were going. He said he spent his time taking members of the State Department and the ambassadorial call home. And he said he'd take them home, put them in the doorway, and say, call the wife, here you be your drunken husband. Made him very popular. But I talked to him at length, and he was very free to talk to me. And he told me a great deal of what had been going on that he knew. He was a graduate of the university not Heidelberg, but the other one right near there, where the German high command had gone to cavalry school. And I said, what time was gearing like? And he said, I tell you what you're giving, Mike. He said, well, he kissed his mother goodnight. He slit her throat with a butcher knife. I never forgot that. But be that as it may, the British and the Americans knew in January 1941 that they were going to attack Russia. Now, what did this really mean? Contrary to what Roosevelt told the American people, Hitler had no intention of having a two-front war. It meant the end of the war, so far as England was concerned, German attacks. They admitted this. This is in the documents. This is not much thing. When Hitler said he was going to attack Russia, mm-hmm. It meant the end of the war against England.
Oh, I see.
Now, they knew this in January 1941. And Roosevelt knew that if the war slackened against England, he could not get the nation to war. Against Japan. Japan, now in the ABC and the ABB agreement of January 1941, the plan was to use Japan as a decoy to get us into war against Germany. That's in the plan. It's there, I find. Diplomat. With no connection with the Council on Foreign Relations, nothing to blemish his record. He had been Woodrow Wilson's last Secretary of State after the other boys had their run-ins with the Council on Foreign Relations, Wilson. And they grew in desperation. He was a very able man. He was a Christian man. Now, if you want support for this, how many of you know Dr. Will McElwain of Pensacola, Florida?
No.
You may verify anything I say from him, because I've had 5 hours of conversation with him on this very topic. Grew, when he went to China, I went to Japan there, had taken the pains to learn Japanese fluently. His first diplomatic assignment had been in Turkey. And he learned Arabic, Turkish Arabic, thinking that was the proper duty of a diplomat. So when he went to Japan, he learned Japanese. But Kanoi didn't notice. So when he received him, he had drawn up a whole line of interpreters. And Gru was presented to Prince Kanoi. I think it was Life, or I guess it was one of the big magazines, had a picture of this. I grew going to see Kanoya and addressing Kanoya in perfect Japanese. And Kanoya's mouth dropped open because he had these four or five interpreters flanking him. But here is an American who speaks Japanese. That was almost too much for Kanoya to take. But it made Kanoya and Drew very, very good friends. In June 1941, what happened? Well, Germany tanked Russia, exactly what they said they'd do. Right on the nose. This made a crucial situation for Roosevelt. And so, in 1941, August, after the Danger of England was over, they had the famous meeting of the Prince of Wales, the Atlantic meeting, at which they drew up the Atlantic Charter. The language, which is a dead giveaway, after the war's over, we will do this and this and the other thing. They had eight provisions. We, United States, allegedly non-belligerent, England a belligerent. Do you get the implications? But the secret agreement was that the United States would inveigle Japan into the war. Now, at the very time that Roosevelt was meeting with Churchill and the Prince of Wales off Newfoundland, the American press did not know what was going on. A black silence had enveloped the White House. They could get nothing out of Roosevelt. They didn't know where he was. You may remember that. At that time, by means we don't know, Prince Kanoya found out about the meeting. And he told Mr. Grew. Grew had known nothing about. Grew was embarrassed. And then Kanoya said, "No, I'm paraphrasing here. I would like to meet with Mr. Roosevelt as Mr. Churchill's meeting with him, that we might settle all the outstanding differences between the United States and Japan." Grew was so impressed with Kanoya that he wrote, and this was his partly his undoing, he wrote a 5,000-word letter, which was Grew's way of doing things. He was a Yale graduate. He wrote beautiful English prose, unbelievably good prose. He was a cultured man. He knew his English as well as he knew his Japanese. Result was that he said to Mr. Roosevelt, now I'm paraphrasing him, "Mr. President, you have your opportunity to bring about a permanent peace with Japan. Mr. Kanoya has done something no Japanese emperor or prime minister has ever done before, namely, an offer to meet with you at the place you designate for a settlement difference." In other words, he would leave Japan, he would come to this country to do this. And Grew was overjoyed because he had this tremendous admiration for Kanoya and Kanoya for Grew. You see, Kanoya's argument was that, look, we're talking now, Roy Churchill and Roosevelt talking, let's us talk. What happened? Roosevelt sent back a letter to, or a telegram to Grew to tell Kanoya that after the differences had been settled, he would be glad to meet with him.
After the
differences were settled. But Grew had warned Roosevelt that if Roosevelt did not act, Kanoya would fall. His party would fall. And Tojo and Toko would take over the militarists. And he also said that we would fall within 3 weeks. The date of this letter, of this final reply of Grew to Roosevelt was August the 26th. On September the 13th or 14th, Kanoya fell. And Tojo and Toko took over. He had nailed it within about 2 days of what would happen. And that's what happened. Now, I had read this in Grew's papers, but I talked to Will McElwain about it. On New Year's Day, of course, Grew was held in confinement in the embassy. He and his wife. His kids were all grown up. And he was held in the embassy. And on Christmas Day, Mrs. Grew was awakened early in the morning by a knock on the door. She was scared. And so to save the ambassador, she went down. She found a big basket in the front door. with all the Christmas goodies, turkey, apple, you name it, there. She said it was a huge basket, about that tall. And she took it all in, it was all for Christmas dinner. And at the bottom, she found this note. "So sorry, Pearl Harbor, your Emperor Hirohito." Now, Drew had told Rosa that Hirohito would not be involved in any more plans, that the Moltres party had taken him over and just pushed him aside. That is why MacArthur, at the end of the war, saved Hirohito. Now, everything I told you now is true. I've paraphrased it, I've reduced it, because Drew was nothing if not worthy. He wrote a whole series of letters, which are beautiful literature, but hard to take in a church like this. Now, this is a conspiracy. There's no doubt about it. The war cabinet meeting on December 3rd, planned for war. There's a friend of mine in Salisbury. Well, his name is Billy or Bucky Walters. At that time, he was one of the decoders of the Japanese Code of the Four Winds, which was being given to Roosevelt. And he has verified everything I've said, because he was a decoder. Dr. Will McElwain told me about being repatriated on the Gripsholm with Ambassador Drew, whom he had known, of course, in Japan, and whom he'd come to love, and of Drew's terrible, terrible feeling that he'd been totally a failure, and that Will McElwain had been trying to tell him he wasn't a failure, that was not his fault, that he'd done exactly what a diplomat should have done.
Were they both in Japan during the war?
They were both in prison. Well, they were in custody, let's put it that way. But the Gripsholm had made a trip, repatriating diplomats and missionaries, and goodness knows why. And it just so happened that they were put on the same voyage as the Gripsholm.
How long have you known all of this?
I was with the One Man Power Commission for 3 years, and I got so fed up with Paul McNutt, and he was drunk, he was disgraceful, and nothing he said made sense. I mean, even the telegram sent, I couldn't make, I had an attorney, I had an aide, nobody could make any sense out of him, and I got fed up with it, and I had been drafted into it.
And how long ago?
What?
How long ago was it?
I was drafted into the War Manpower Commission in March 1941. No, 42, excuse me.
You began to find out all these details back then, even?
Yeah. there were leaks, and I found some of the stuff out while I was with the War Manpower Commission. I was not. The War Manpower Commission had a commission in Washington over which Paul McNutt was chairman. That had. It had a series of sort of intermediaries all over the country. And then under them, in the third echelon, it had area directors. I was an area director. So I did not have immediate contact with Paul McNutt unless we were called to Washington to meeting. And I was called to Washington meeting like that. I went to one in, well, actually, I'll never forget, it was at the Lord Baltimore Hotel in Baltimore. And that was a nightmare.
How
did all
this stay covered so long?
Well,
it really hasn't. Just, I mean, it pops up here and there all over the place.
For a long time. For a long time. I think it was August 1944. I was absolutely fed up with things. Or was it July? I don't remember. Anyway, I went to my immediate boss and told him I was fed up, I was sick of it, I couldn't care less about the War Manpower Commission. It was inefficient, it was sloppy, it was a lot of things. And not to mention a drunken mess. And he sort of agreed with me, but he said, if we let you go, you'll go be drafted in the army. And so I said to him, I said, can I depend on that? And he said, no. He said, you can't depend on anything. So, but they realized I'd reached the limit of my endurance, and so I was transferred to Pearl Harbor Investigation.
Hmm.
thing. He was mentioning it once before. Some admiral wrote a book spelled
yeah.
out.
Uh-huh.
Who was that?
Oh, Admiral Kimmel. Yeah, my story of Pearl Harbor.
Let me say one thing, and then I'd like to ask another question. One of the most profound emotional shocks I ever had, and I was in my room in my whole life, was when I got to Japan and found them with utterly delightful people.
Uh-huh.
It really was a horrible shock because, it is the propaganda was so strong. I mean, I can take them all the week to have a little home.
Well, they do, don't they?
So it is. They were very intriguing people. I mean, charming.
I know.
And I think it was the first week there was just almost really bad, and that sense of what that sense of thing. But another thing I like is you wrote one time in 12 that case about the admiral wanting to be court martialed.
Oh, that was Kimmel. After Pearl Harbor, Kimmel and Short were relieved of their command. Now, they could not court-martial him because when you have a court-martial under military law, you must have witness for the defense who know what's going on. Now, this is what Senator George told me and Senator Russell. They put Kimmel in charge of the Norfolk Navy Yard, the largest naval installation on the East Coast. They sent General Short to the Panama City Air Base. Now, you see, they didn't demote them. They didn't. See, if they demoted them, then they could only enter court-martial. They couldn't touch them. And as long as they didn't touch them, then they couldn't talk. You can't talk. Now, they had them. Now, what happened was this. That Short, so had a very short fuse at Panama City. When he go to Washington, he go to Dick Russell's door, Senator Russell, kick it open, Mr. West closed, and it made no difference what was going on. He bust in, and he goes up and says, I want to be court-martial. Get red in the face. And of course, Russell says, I can't court-martial. And he yell it, I want to be court-martial. Then he go back to his Panama City base and cool off. Now, Kimmel was, I don't know, he was more of a gentleman and more controlled. He just had a slow fuse, but he would come up from he'd come up from Norfolk, and he'd go to Russell and George and everybody else he could find, tidings, and demand to be court-martialed. Well, George said, when you have a man in the Army Navy who demands about once a month he wants to be court-martialed, and he gets mad when you don't court-martial him. He says, you begin to catch on that something's radically wrong. He said he'd never had that experience before. Well, any of you been in the service, ordinarily you don't go around and say, please court-martial me. I demand to be court-martialed. I'm going to be mad at you if you don't court-martial him. You see that? Well, in 1944, rumors began to break out, and Roosevelt appointed what was known as the Roberts Commission. by Justice Roberts, Supreme Court. Well, Roberts' commission played the ball nicely. It made amazing conclusions. One, Pearl Harbor happened. That was hardly a debate. Two, the Army wasn't guilty. The Navy wasn't guilty. And then it closed. Well, that satisfied nobody. Because it didn't prove the Army wasn't guilty. It just made a statement. It couldn't prove it because that left the cow in the bag. But you see, an election was coming up, and Thomas Dewey, found out about what had really happened at Pearl Harbor. And he went to Roosevelt and said he was going to let the cat out of the bag. And Roosevelt pleaded with him not to do it on the basis that it would wreck national morale, which was true. And so Dewey said, promised not to do it in that election in 1944. However, by this time, Senator George and Senator Russell and a man whom you may not remember, Senator Stiles Bridges, realized that something had to be done. And so they got the Pearl Harbor Investigating Commission created. And It worked for about a year and a half or 2 years and brought out the Pearl Harbor report. Now, I'm going to tell you something.
Now, were you on that?
No, I was not. I worked in the papers they used, but it was not. Oh, no. No, that's from most of the members of Congress.
All right. I know
people. At a private meeting, which I attended up in Washington, at which Stiles Bridges was the guest of honor, I will not tell you how I got there. It was in a closed room in a hotel. This was in 1944. Stiles Bridges told us, a very small group, no newspaper, no media presence, about the 1938 treaty between Great Britain and Russia and Germany. He told us about some of the, the ABD, the ABC agreements. He knew about them. And he didn't, it was not leaked to the press, but it was leaked to to a select group. At the time this happened, I was working on Pearl Harbor document. At the time of the meeting. That's my background on it. Now, why did it happen? If you read the Roosevelt papers, which I have done, and if you see the papers of Henry Wallace and Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, which I have read, and some of Hall's material, although Hall really wasn't as much involved as the others, Roosevelt had four purposes in view. One was to revamp his political structure, to get conservative support is over against the liberal support which he lost. The liberals were divided. There's a group known as the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which had a big fight in Detroit in 1939 over whether they should support the Allies or not. One group led by Reinhold Niebuhr said that war was justified on such an occasion, whereupon the Fellowship of Reconciliation promptly threw him out. And they had a big fight. The pacifists had a bitter fight. But most of the pacifists were against Roosevelt in this. And so that he lost a lot of his liberal and radical support. The nation and the new republic particularly turned against him. And he was in bad way. And so he realized he needed, for the election 1940, he realized he needed a new source of support. Secondly, he wanted to become a dictator in this country. There's no question about it. If you remember the OPA, the Office of Price Administration, if you remember the War Manpower Commission, in which I was involved, if you remember the various other commissions which he created, you'll find this was the case. During the war, he got tangled up with Sears Roebuck. I forget the exact circumstances, but the OPA got tangled with Sears Roebuck, and the president of the company at the time was a man named Sewell Avery. And Roosevelt used the army in the
Montgomery War.
I guess it wasn't Montgomery. Yeah. Anyway, Roosevelt used the army to try to arrest Sewell Avery, and they brought him out of his office in a chair. Well, the Chicago Tribune under Colonel Robert R. McCormick was not exactly friendly to Roosevelt, and the photographers took pictures of this, I think it was 70-year-old Sewell Avery being called out by the army. And that resulted in a circuit court case, which the presiding judge on the circuit court, I'm trying to remember his name, it's a funny name, really slashed Roosevelt down. At the same time, the Japanese relocation deal came up before the court. That was a tyrannical act, a dictatorial act, had no justification of any kind, and they brought suit before the same judge. I wish I could remember his name. Anyway, he gave a tremendous decision in which he pointed out it was a violation of the Constitution, a few other things, and slashed at Roosevelt. The third reason was to aid Russia. There was no justification for going to war with England in June 19 or in September 1941. None at all. The danger in England was over. It was renewed because we'd gotten the war and opened up another second front. But Hitler's whole intention was a second front in Russia. I should say a second Russia. And he kept pleading for a second front to help him out because he got in trouble. Stalin did. And so we went to war to aid Stalin. That was the third point. And of course, the fourth point was to get us out of the Depression. The New Deal had been a complete failure. 1937, October, November, December, we had the worst business collapse in American history. Not stock market, but business. And Roosevelt knew. And he knew that the only resort he had was war. He tried all his other tricks, none worked.
Called it depression.
Yeah, it was a depression of 1938, which he had caused, and then could not remedy. Those were the four factors which brought about the war. Now, yes?
Something I've been wondering about for a long time, it's kind of past it now, and that's in the recent Japanese history that I've heard it said a number of times that everything changed when Tojo and Yamamoto and those took control there.
They did.
But there's some pretty bad guys before that. Now, they went to Manchuria in 1931 and chopped that up pretty badly.
Yep.
Korea in 1930, China in 1933.
Yes, that's quite true.
So they had a pretty good warlord history, I think.
Yes, I'm not denying that. However,
they were doing the same thing to the British.
You must remember something. In the Treaty of 1904, ending the war of 1904, Theodore Roosevelt had promised Manchuria Japan, and in 1919, and they didn't give it to him. Now, I'm not defending the Japanese attack on Korea or on China, but in on the others I can, and in the sense that they were double crossed. However, Japan was wrong in that. But for over a century, England had seized Chinese territory. And in the Opium War, they seized Hong Kong. That's how they got Hong Kong. And in succeeding wars, and in succeeding treaties, England very graciously gave away territory they didn't own in the Far East.
It sounds like Roosevelt was trying to do that too.
Yeah, sure.
I have to go back to that mountain.
Well, in 1943, at the Cairo Conference, he told Korea not to worry. That Korea would be all right, they'd have their independence. But at Yalta, he divided Korea, North and South Korea. And he gave North Korea to the control of the Russians, who had absolutely no right to it. Isn't that right? Sure is. But he did reserve South Korea for the Koreans. I mean, that was marvelous of him to give half to the Koreans. They hadn't owned the whole thing.
Maxine, what about the final days of the battle in Germany? Do you think that they were held back? I mean, America.
No question about it.
What allies did they held back?
No question. I've talked to a lot of people who were there in the army. There was no question they were held back. And they were held back to give Russia a chance to go in, because Roosevelt had agreed to that. See, at Yalta, Roosevelt had agreed to allow Hitler to get everything that he asked Hitler for in 1938, and Hitler hadn't given to him, namely Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, Romania, and European Turkey. That's all he wanted. And they had agreed at the conference of 1943 to divide Germany up. And so Berlin being in the east sector, you couldn't have the American army go storming in the east sector. That was holy ground.
Well, I remember reading that there was nothing between the Allied armies and Berlin.
That's quite correct. Except Roosevelt's agreement with Russia. which the papers didn't publish.